I want you to imagine a chaotic scene for a moment. Just, picture it in your mind's eye.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
You're standing on this gray, cracked asphalt. The air around you is super thick, and it's carrying that biting, sharp sting of tear gas that just immediately burns the back of your throat.
Oh, yeah, that awful metallic kind of burn.
Exactly. And right in front of you, there's this mechanical, heavily armored riot police officer.
Right.
And this figure is advancing at like a solid, just impenetrable black wall toward a cornered youth who's wearing nothing but a simple t-shirt.
That is an incredibly tense image.
It is. Now imagine you're an artist and you're trying to paint that specific brand of terrifying rigidity. You want to capture the absolute unyielding power of steel and tactical gear.
Which is usually done with like heavy oils or acrylics.
Right. But here's the twist. Your only tool is water.
Wow. I mean, it sounds like an absolute contradiction in terms.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, you're trying to capture the ultimate symbol of rigid control, of institutional force, using what is arguably one of the most unstable, uncontrollable mediums in the entire art world.
Welcome to today's deep dive. We're taking you on a journey into a really intense audio debate between two critics who are dissecting this striking watercolor painting.
And it's a phenomenal piece of work to analyze.
The piece is called La Sin Razón de la Fuerza, which translates to The Unreason of Force. It's by the artist Jairo Duque.
And it forms a really crucial part of his larger series called Estallido Social in Colombia, or the Social Uprising in Colombia.
Yeah, and the source material we're working with today is just a fascinating breakdown.
It really is. The two critics in the audio spend a massive amount of time tearing into the political, historical, and artistic weight of this specific painting.
They really get into the weeds on it.
They do. They're arguing over how a simple piece of paper and some pigment can spark such polarized debate about ethics and authority.
Before we jump in, though, a quick note for you, the listener. Because our source material touches on the incredibly raw nerve of the 2021 Colombian protests, specifically regarding state police forces and civilian protesters, our goal today isn't to take a political side.
Right, absolutely not.
We're going to act as your impartial guides through the profound and sometimes controversial metaphors these critics are arguing over.
We're just reporting on their ideas, not endorsing real-world politics.
Exactly. We just want to help you understand the profound statements being made through the artwork itself.
And I think the central tension in the debate really revolves around how an artist translates immense real-world physical conflict into a two-dimensional space.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because the very first thing that jumps out from our source is this massive thematic paradox we just mentioned.
The watercolor paradox.
Yes. Using watercolor to paint a riot police officer, to me, that's like trying to sculpt a military tank out of, I don't know, liquid.
It just doesn't compute at first glance.
It doesn't. And I have to push back on this artistic choice right out of the gate, much like one of the critics in our source does. Doesn't watercolor usually feel a bit too soft?
You mean stylistically?
Yeah, like when you think of watercolor, your mind immediately goes to delicate landscapes or soft horizons or those botanical prints you see in cafes.
Right, something very gentle.
It just feels fundamentally too delicate for a scene of brutal contemporary political violence, you know?
Well, what's fascinating here is how Duque actually weaponizes the specific physical properties of his materials. He uses them to create an intensely oppressive atmosphere, completely subverting that exact expectation you just mentioned.
Okay, so how does he actually do that? Because water is still water.
Right. But he isn't using standard, flimsy watercolor paper. The source details that he uses 640-gram rough-grain Arches paper.
Wait, 640-gram normal watercolor paper is usually around, what, 300 grams, right?
Exactly, 300 is standard. So at 640 grams, he's essentially painting on dense cardboard. Yeah, which means he can flood the entire page with water without the paper warping, buckling, or breaking down.
So he's just soaking this thing.
He creates an absolute pool on the page, and into that standing water, he introduces Daniel Smith granulating paints.
Granulating paints, how are those different?
So granulating paints behave very differently than standard watercolors. The pigment particles are physically heavier.
Okay.
They don't just dissolve smoothly and evenly into a nice uniform wash. Instead, as the water swirls around and eventually evaporates, these heavy pigments settle unpredictably into the deep microscopic valleys of that rough grain paper.
Oh, so the paint is physically fighting itself on the page. It's separating as it dries.
Exactly. If water and the pigment bleed, they clash and they completely refuse to respect any clean borders or lines.
That sounds incredibly chaotic.
Visually, according to the critical analysis in our source, this uncontrollable technique perfectly simulates the suffocating, chaotic, swirling smoke of tear gas.
Oh, that is brilliant.
It's not a precise, neat drawing. The medium itself is an act of aesthetic rebellion. The yep. artist is basically surrendering control to the water.
Which perfectly mirrors the sheer unpredictability and chaos of a social uprising in the streets.
Right. It's an atmosphere that makes you, the viewer, feel literally visually drowned.
That's a wild concept to wrap your head around.
Mm.
The paint itself is rebelling against the structure of the paper, mimicking the protest.
It's so layered.
But what's crazy is that even though the watery paints are creating this chaotic, breathless atmosphere of tear gas, the actual architectural structure of the image, like the line work and the geometry, aggressively boxes the viewer in.
Oh, the composition is so rigid compared to the paint.
Yeah. The source breaks down the artist's line work, and it's framed as this absolute masterclass in visualizing an unequal fight.
The asymmetry is just staggering when you look at how the two figures are constructed.
You have the heavily armed agent representing the ESMAD, which is Colombia's mobile anti-riot squad.
Right.
And this figure is drawn with incredibly hard, angular mechanical lines.
Like a machine.
Exactly. The debaters note that he doesn't even look organic. He looks like a literal cog in a machine of state repression, totally devoid of individual humanity.
So sharp angles and armor.
But then, conversely, you look at the crouched youth on the ground. That figure is drawn with entirely organic, flexible, loose lines.
Emphasizing that human frailty.
Right. It's the mechanized institution versus the fragile human body.
The critics point out that the lines themselves are taking a moral stance before you even have time to process the narrative of the scene.
And it doesn't stop with just the line work. The whole scene is engineered to make you feel physically trapped.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's all about the geometry and the perspective.
Right. Talk about the perspective for a second.
So the perspective in this painting is incredibly low. You're almost right down at ground level with the crouching youth.
Like you're down there on the asphalt with them.
Exactly. And from that low vantage point, there's a very deep vanishing point stretching far, far down the empty street behind them.
So the street essentially acts as a visual funnel.
That's the perfect way to describe it. The low perspective and that deep funneling effect make the police officer loom in the foreground like a massive dark mountain.
Just completely blocking the only exit.
Yep. Meanwhile, the youth at the bottom of the funnel is miniaturized. According to the source, this spatial arrangement visually communicates the crushing, suffocating weight of state power.
Before a single physical blow has even been struck.
Exactly. The state is crushing the youth with its sheer spatial presence alone.
Which actually brings us to the color theory. Because that psychological feeling of being crushed is heavily amplified by the palette he uses.
The colors are so striking.
The painting is overwhelmingly dominated by these hostile, dehumanized, cold tones. Deep ashy grays, metallic blues, sickly violet tones.
It looks like a concrete world totally devoid of life.
But then, right in the middle of all this visual ash, there is a violent interruption of color.
The flag.
The yellow, blue, and red of the Colombian flag, and it's wrapped directly around the vulnerable youth.
It's a massive thermal and emotional contrast, which the critics point out is a very deliberate psychological tool.
I have to ask, though, and this is something I'm genuinely wrestling with while listening to the critics and our source, doesn't wrapping the figure in the national flag border on being a bit too literal?
How do you mean?
Like, doesn't it risk turning a highly nuanced, complex piece of fine art into an overly heroic, almost cheesy political pamphlet?
You know, one of the debaters in our source actually raises that exact concern. They question if the flag cheapens the artistic subtlety.
Right, because it's such a loud symbol.
But the counterargument presented by the other critic is really compelling. It actually relies on how our eyes physically process color.
Oh, like biological optics.
Yeah. Warm colors like the yellow and red in the flag naturally advance toward the viewer's eye, while cold colors like those ashy grays and metallic blues in the background, they recede.
So the artist is physically pulling the youth forward while pushing the oppressive background away.
Exactly. He's manipulating your biological optical response to isolate the vulnerability.
That is incredibly smart.
The critic argues that this stark thermal contrast isn't about cheap patriotic heroism at all. It explicitly positions the artwork as an uncompromising historical testimony of a specific local struggle.
Grounding it in reality.
Right. You cannot separate this image from the reality of the 2021 Colombian protests. These were real young people, largely from working class sectors, who were out there in the streets.
So the flag insists that this isn't just an abstract representation of sadness or conflict.
It's a document of who had the weapons and who was putting their lives on the line in a very specific place and time.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because if the prevailing argument is that this painting serves as an unbreakable historical document of Colombia in 2021, anchoring the abstract violence to a very real working class struggle, here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, the twist.
Yes. Our source drops a massive factual bombshell about how this painting was actually constructed.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, when I first heard this, it totally threw me for a loop.
The revelation about the reference photo entirely flips the context of the piece.
It really does. So despite being the iconic, defining image of Duke's Estallido Social in Colombia series, a series dedicated to local memory, the reference photo that he used to paint the police officer was not taken in Colombia.
Not even on the same continent, practically.
No. It was a photograph taken in Whittier, California, in October 2022.
A full year after the Colombian protests had peaked.
Exactly. And I really have to challenge the source's logic here. I'd be shouting this if I were in the room with those critics.
What's your issue with it?
Well, if the artist's entire goal is to create a localized historical document of Colombian protests to preserve memory against official state narratives, doesn't using an American cop from a year later completely ruin the authenticity of that testimony?
It seems like it would, right.
How can it be a Colombian historical document if the antagonist is Californian?
On the surface, it absolutely seems like it would pull the rug out from under the whole piece. Like it invalidates its claim to local history.
Yeah, that was my exact thought.
But the source frames this geographic contradiction brilliantly. Far from ruining the local testimony, this detail actually deepens the philosophical weight of the painting.
How so?
By using a Californian reference photo and adapting it, literally dropping it into a Colombian context, yeah, and wrapping the victim in Colombian colors, the artist is proving a terrifying point.
Which is?
The aesthetics of state power are a global, universal language.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So the armor, the stance, the intimidation, it's standardized everywhere. You don't need to see a badge, yeah, to know exactly what that figure represents.
Exactly. The mechanical posture of riot police, the tactical gear, the faceless helmets, the physical geometry of intimidation, it looks utterly identical whether you're standing on a street in Bogota, Colombia, or Whittier, California.
That gives me chills, honestly.
You, as a listener, have to consider how the dynamics of power and vulnerability transcend borders.
It's everywhere.
The artist is taking a systemic, worldwide choreography of violence and localizing it to say, yes, this machine of repression operates globally. It is an international language of control. But right here, in my country, these are the specific bodies it is breaking.
That is a brilliant synthesis. It's the universal language of violence adapted to a local tragedy. It shows that the mechanism of oppression doesn't need a passport.
The machinery of force is a global export.
Wow. And that realization about the universality of the imagery naturally brings us to another incredibly specific detail from our source regarding where this painting actually ended up being viewed.
Which is fascinating in itself.
Because if the aesthetics of violence translate globally, how does a global audience react?
The exhibition context adds a whole new layer of complexity to the debate.
It does. This very painting was exhibited in an art show called Trastio, which translates to moving or displacement at the Art Box Gallery in Zug, Switzerland, in July 2024. Yes. Now, I have to admit, I struggle to visualize this interaction. Switzerland is famously one of the most peaceful, neutral countries on Earth, with a very, very different relationship to street protests and state violence.
Extremely different.
It's like playing a heavy metal song at a classical music concert. How does a Swiss audience, an audience that likely has absolutely no idea what the ES Mad even is, or the history of the 2021 Colombian uprising, process a painting this culturally and politically charged?
This raises an important question about how art functions outside of its native habitat, far from the context that birthed it.
Right, because it's untethered from its original soil.
The critics in our source argue that it's exactly the physical technique we talked about earlier that serves as the universal hook for an international audience.
You mean the heavy paper, the bleeding, granulating paint, the thermal contrast?
Yes, all of that. The unbearable physical tension of the watercolor, that suffocating funnel-like perspective pulling your eye down the empty street, and the sheer visual weight of that dark mechanical figure looming over the colorful, fragile one.
It bypasses the intellect and goes straight for the gut.
Exactly. That tension grabs the European viewer on a purely emotional, visceral level long before they ever walk up to read the little political context placard on the gallery wall.
The technique basically catches them by the throat.
They don't need to know the acronym of the police force to feel the dread.
It makes them feel the sting of the tear gas and the claustrophobia before they know the geography. The universal language of violence we just talked about works on the gallery viewer just as effectively as it works on the street.
And that psychological grip leads to the final and perhaps most crucial debate our source tackles.
Which is?
The narrative structure of the confrontation itself. The painting represents an eternal cycle of resistance because it deliberately lacks a resolution.
Right. It's a suspended moment in time.
The baton has not fallen. The youth has not escaped. It is a permanently suspended second.
It's just frozen.
Everything is on the brink of breaking. The tension is at its absolute maximum, but the release never comes.
And the debaters in the source argue that this isn't just an aesthetic artistic choice to build tension. They say it's actually a profound ethical responsibility on the part of the artist.
Yes. According to the analysis, the artist has an ethical duty not to offer a comforting resolution to the viewer.
Because that would be too easy.
Think about it. If the painting showed the youth escaping, you'd feel a sense of relief, you'd exhale.
Right.
If it showed the strike landing, you'd feel the finalized tragedy, you'd mourn, and then you'd move on. Both scenarios offer catharsis.
An emotional off-ramp.
Exactly. But by leaving the conflict unresolved, the art refuses to let you be a passive consumer who gets to walk away feeling resolved. It forces a dilemma onto you.
It demands that you sit in the discomfort. You can't just close the book on the event.
And by forcing the viewer to hold that tension, the source argues the artwork serves as an active tool of political awareness for new generations.
It ensures that the struggle isn't neatly filed away.
Or erased by official sanitized historical narratives that so often follow periods of intense civil unrest. The resistance is kept perpetually alive, actively vibrating on the canvas.
It acts as an active memory demanding attention. Rather than just a closed chapter gathering dust in some archive, it's a tool for conscience.
It absolutely is.
So what does this all mean? We've explored how Jarrow Duke takes a wildly uncontrollable medium like water and heavy pigment and weaponizes it to interrogate the cold, mechanical rigidity of institutional power.
Beautifully said.
Through deep geometric funnels that physically make your eye feel trapped, through striking thermal color contrasts that highlight human fragility while manipulating our visual psychology, and through a globally sourced reference image from California, this painting entirely transcends its local origins in Colombia.
It becomes so much bigger.
It becomes a universal testament to human vulnerability in the face of mechanized force, capable of grabbing an audience in Switzerland by the throat. Art doesn't just record history for the archives. When it suspends time like this, withholding that comforting resolution, it forces us to interrogate our own position, our own comfort, and our own ethics in the face of authority.
I want to leave you, the listener, with one final thought to mull over. Something to explore on your own that builds on the psychology of what we've discussed today.
Oh, I like this. Lay it on us.
We live in an era where we are constantly, daily, bombarded by chaotic, high-definition smartphone video footage of real-life protests, conflicts, and police actions.
It's everywhere.
You can open any social media app right now and scroll through hours of actual kinetic violence in real time. Yet, how is it that a static, silent watercolor painting a completely motionless piece of heavy paper with water and pigment manages to hold our attention, make us hold our breath, and force us to feel the reality of that power imbalance in a way that mindlessly scrolling past a hyper-realistic, high-definition video simply cannot?
That is such a fascinating point. A completely silent, motionless painting speaking louder and demanding more from us than an endless feed of high-def video.
It's wild to think about.
It really makes you question how we consume the reality of conflict. Something to think about the next time you find yourself doom-scrolling.
Definitely.
Thanks for diving deep with us today.